here live from the Hof van Lieren in Antwerp, and today we invited Professor in International Economics Elsa Leromain. We are Charlotte and Céline, you are listening to Profcast.
Welcome, Professor Leromain. You specialize in international trade and economic geography. You must have been very busy in the past years. And we saw that you've been working extensively on Brexit, on trade relations between the US and China, and of course, and more recently also on the Ukraine war. It seems that your research is often intertwined with politics. What attracted you to this field specifically?
So as a bachelor student, even a high school student, I wanted to specialize in political science, and then life happens. So I ended up doing a bachelor in social sciences, so I kept this kind of a bit more broader perspective, and eventually I picked economics, but I still keep this strong interests for social sciences and, as you picked up, political science. And it's also very important for me to do a research that is actually timely and can be, you know, echoing a lot of the debates that we may have. So that, I guess, also reflects the choice of topics.
Okay. A recent example, of course, is the war in Ukraine, as Céline said. What's the global impact of this war on international trade, and how did it affect global financial markets?
So, I mean, you may have seen from the headlines that there has been quite of an important impact on global trade of the Ukraine war. So first of all, because it directly affected production in Ukraine. So there has been a lot of shortages in terms of agricultural products that Ukraine was exporting. But also because as a result of the war, there was a lot of sanctions put in place, typically by Western countries in the Euro area, being one fervent country doing so. That also affected exports from Russia into Europe, but also exports of these firms into Russia. So that's kind of the two things that led to very big global trade reduction in specific products.
And I can imagine that you would have to react really quickly, of course, because these events, they occur and research has to follow. How do you deal with that? How do you adjust to the changing political climate?
So that's why I studied the response in stock market prices in the context of the Ukraine war, because it's, as you said, I mean, typically there's a lag between what the events happen and when you actually get access to data to be able to say something. So typically then you have to think about, you know, what is the best way, given the timing, you can say something good, but, you know, given the constraints. And so I also kind of faced a similar constraint when looking at the effect of Brexit referendum, where we also had to pick some outcomes where we had data where we thought could still give us some interesting insights.
Yeah, maybe we can zoom in a little bit more also on your Brexit research as well, because when we were doing our homework, we looked into your research portfolio, and well, it does seem that you've become quite the Brexit expert throughout the years. Could you talk a bit more about that and maybe share some results that are still important today?
Yeah, so I've been working quite a long time on Brexit, and specifically in the time between the referendum and the actual exits of the UK from the European Union, because I was in London then. And so, again, there was kind of a real importance for having insights. So we also looked at different things then that I think are still relevant for understanding the impact of Brexit after the actual exits. So, for instance, we've seen that straight after the referendum, there has been a very important depreciation of the pound that affected prices because, you know, from one day to the next, imports became much more important. But also domestic goods also saw their price increase because they were used estimated inputs to produce these kind of goods. And so we have seen that this had a direct effect on consumers and households in the UK. And I think this kind of result is also relevant for understanding the current inflation crisis, where specific products, for instance, to come back to the Ukraine discussion, like agricultural products, electricity, have seen their prices specifically increased. And so the tools that we'll build is also important to understand how that would affect a given household in the UK, but also how would that affect heterogeneity in the UK and, I mean, more broadly now in Europe.
That's very interesting to see how everything will sort of intertwines, because they do seem to be separate events, but then yeah, the outcome still impacts us today. And I think a lot of people are unaware of that if you're not involved in that field. So yeah, that's a very valuable insight.
So it has to say, because I think things Brexit, there has been a lot of other shocks that kind of accumulated on top of everything else. So indeed, there was the first big inflation that was due to the referendum, so the pound. Then there was the inflation that came from, you know, reduction in trade barriers, but also COVID that happened at the exact same time. And now you have Ukraine. So I think in that perspective, like the UK is kind of affected much more than all the countries around that also have to face similar shock, but for Brexit. Well, I mean, we've seen recently that this seems to be, at least the inflation is lower, meaning that the price are increasing at a lower rate. But I think it's unlikely that there is going to be no inflation at all, meaning no changes in prices for the foreseeable future. I mean, the hope is, you know, central banks have been doing a lot to intervene and try to slow this growth in prices. And hopefully that, I mean, the idea is that eventually we should see a reduction in inflation. Saying that there will be no inflation, it's hard to say, because there was really a big change in kind of paradigm, or in you know, with no inflation, that was kind of out of the picture for the last 15 years, maybe. And suddenly you're talking again about, you know, inflation and very important things that we had never seen for these last decades. So once it starts, it takes kind of a long time to fade away.
Okay, so and do you think we should be worried here in Belgium for other crises coming?
I mean, I think we should be worried if we are thinking about consumers and households in Belgium, but also in Europe and in the UK, that experience a very big increase in their day-to-day life. So I think, you know, we all face price increases, but we don't have the same savings. We also don't have the same kind of cushion in what you are consuming, right? So I guess if you have a lot of leisure and you're traveling a lot and suddenly prices increases, it's very easy to reduce that amount, right? And then you can still have enough money to pay your rent, to pay your electricity bills, to pay all this. For households that don't have typically the money for traveling and for doing all these leisures, these price increases are actually much more important. And so I think in the long run, we may be concerned that these kind of prices have effects that are long-term effects on, you know, the wealth and how much money these people have. So I think that we should be worrying in terms or potential inequality effects and kind of, you know, deepening the gaps between the ones that can survive. And anyway, these kind of inflation thing, okay, would be a big hit for one day, but then they will recover the next period. But if you think of these people that are very constrained, I mean, they cannot save, and that will affect pension maybe eventually, you know, things that that are important.
And are there certain mechanisms that we can implement to prepare us for the future, or that our country should implement to prepare all the households to make them future-proof?
Well, I guess it's a difficult question, because it's always, you know, where there is the economics and then there's the political choice. So of course, you would think that probably the states in that respect may have something to do in trying to at least reduce these inequalities. So at least, you know, the Belgian government put in place some things to help, at least on a short-term basis, households to be able to pay their electricity bill or not have to, and just give them money so that temporarily they could at least survive. So these kind of initiatives, I think, are going in the right direction. Whether there needs to be more, net social nets, I think at least something that probably should be thought of, because it's very likely that these global shocks are going to come back because of the nature of the economy as of today.
We've already discussed quite a few topics, and of course, you also teach in international economics, among other things, but I was also wondering, given the current climate that we're in, if you would have to give your students one thing to remember at the end of your classes, what would that be?
Well, I think these kind of changing landscapes, and the fact that through trade mostly, but also other type of globalization, there is a lot of interdependence between countries, and that's kind of a recent feature. And so that has a lot of impact on how we typically think about, you know, effect of a given shock on a given country. And so that also, you know, thinking about Brexit, thinking about the war in Ukraine, thinking about Trump, I mean, it's, I think, very important to kind of understand how these relationships are, to also understand that things that, you know, back in the day happened in China would have no consequences whatsoever here, now actually matters.
Okay, well, I think that would be a very good lesson to take home at the end of a class, if you ask me. Well, but maybe to follow up a little bit more as well on the international, and also zooming in on you as a professor. You studied and worked at several international institutions in Paris and in London. How were those experiences for you? And would you recommend others to have these kinds of, well, international experiences as well?
So in Paris, I was at Paris School of Economics, where I did my PhD, and London School of Economics, where I did my postdoc, and I worked on Brexit. So I think, at least compared to the Department of Economics here, they are institutions that are mainly specialized in economics and social sciences. So they're much bigger in scope, and there's a lot of things happening. You have a lot of seminars. They're a big mass of people. So that, I think, was also, especially at the beginning of a career, something that is a bit thrilling. You get a lot from lots of good people. And I think that that's kind of affect also your mindset and makes you want to contribute to this dynamic environment. So I would definitely recommend anyone, you know, doing economics and wanted to get a bit of international and dynamic environment to kind of consider going abroad.
I can imagine, yeah. It seems like a very valuable experience. But maybe at the same time, are there any challenges that you've faced along your international trajectory?
Yeah, so, I mean, Paris indeed was not an international experience for me because I'm French. I mean, it was still going from the south of France up to Paris, but nothing comparable. But yeah, London, I guess it is indeed very easy because it's one of the most international city in the world, probably in Europe. So, and with English, you kind of go everywhere. So I guess the hardest part was to integrate the actual true British society. because I was a bit like in this very international bubble through work, but also through my life outside of work. And that I found really enriching, also from the personal perspective. And because you end up at some point, you know, giving different perspective on things, and it also makes you challenge your references and the way you've been brought up to think, and to kind of get exposed to, well, you could do things differently. So I think that was very important. Coming to Belgium, I guess I decided to move back after, well, a bit just before the Brexit actually happened. And I thought I was quite happy to actually be there and not in the UK at that point, even though I love London. And I feel, so I live in Brussels, so Brussels has a bit of these, at a much smaller scale, but feel of like, or at least European vibe. And I do have, you know, this kind of diversity that I also liked in London to a much smaller scale, of course. I think coming to Antwerp, you do have an international thing, but to me it was much harder because there's the language barrier, which I never faced neither in Brussels nor in London. And maybe the same way I found it difficult in London to integrate the British society, I think in integrating the, you know, Flemish society without being fluent is kind of challenging to some extent. But again, I think it's on a personal level. I mean, I've been trying to learn Dutch. I also feel that I'm now truly experiencing what it is to be in Belgium, because I've seen, you know, one part, I've been a lot. I was working in Wallonia, I live in Brussels, and it's kind of very, I mean, there's a big border, I feel, and that it, I'm probably one of the only ones to cross every day. So I feel like it's helped me getting integrated in Belgium, I think, to work in Antwerp, strangely enough. So.
No, I can see that, definitely. And good on you for trying, attempting Dutch, because it's not an easy feat. Yeah. Silly question, maybe, but do you have a favorite Dutch word so far?
Allee.
You teach students very practical academic skills in your research methods course. In what way are these practical academic skills important for students outside of the university?
So we're in the context of this course, we're trying to at least, you know, have the student understand what doing research is or how research is being done. And doing so, I think they learn very applicable skills for outside university, even though they don't happen to do research afterwards. Because I think doing research kind of forces you to think about a problem and formulate this problem and the implication of that problem, and then finding a solution with the constraints that you have. That could be timing, that could be the data that are available or not, and so on. So I think that's kind of also, it's very applicable skills in the work context, because probably, you know, being an economist outside, they will have much less time to think about these things. They have to produce in a report that is, you know, containing to some extent some research or insights from what people are doing here at the university or elsewhere. I also think that we try to convey that they, you know, doing research, it's also talking about research, which is a skill that, you know, talking about something you've done and summarizing in a very neat way is very important in any kind of job that you end up doing afterwards. And so writing about it is also kind of, I think, go hand in hand. And again, I mean, Peru Poly will have to produce much more notes and short summaries and, you know, that we ever do here writing articles. So I do think sometimes it's hard to convince the students that it actually makes sense for them to do that, especially because we don't have a research master. So it's just 1 year and then most of them don't do a PhD. But at least I try, because I do think that even though it seems very abstract and the stuff that they look at, but I think through the process you learn a lot and you also learn to be independent, which can be challenging because it's really into your face and probably it's the first time that they are asked to be so independent, but it's also something that is very valuable later on.
Yes, you clearly are very passionate about it.
I was just going to say, I feel the enthusiasm all the way from here. So okay. If your students feel that as well, I'm sure they'll see their...
I'm not sure, but okay.
And maybe to refer to you personally, I'm interested, did you always know you were going to work in academia and want to do research? Or did that kind of just happen? Because I think a lot of students sort of maybe don't know the existence of doing a PhD until a professor actually tells them, like, you might be able to do one. How was that in your case?
No, it was a long, long journey. I mean, I started when I was doing, you know, first 2 years of bachelor, the social sciences degree. One of the direct track was to be a researcher. And back then I was saying, this is the worst thing in the world. I don't want to be someone in the tower. I don't want to be a researcher. So that was me at like 18. And then eventually through university, I started reading about research. I actually understood what it was about. And I thought, oh, that might be good. So I did a research master's in France, which is kind of the first, you know, entry thing to a PhD. And at the same time, a research internship in a research center. And where there I grasped, like, okay, I could see myself doing this for longer. So then I enrolled for a PhD. But after my PhD, I actually thought, well, do I really want to be a professor? And I had this kind of back and forth love-hate relationship between academia and outside academia. In London, I considered leaving and I applied for think tank jobs. And it kind of came back to me that there was something about academia that I really liked. But so I think it's important actually to allow yourself to ask these questions, because I feel like I also felt, well, if I just right after my PhD take a professor position, it just happens, right? And then I don't want to be this person at 50 thinking, what have I done with my life? Am I just there because, well, there was the next door to open? And so, yeah, no, at least now I know why I'm here. And I also know that I can go somewhere else if at some point I'm fed up. But I think I try to do research in a way that at least I feel like keep this kind of connection. Ground and connection with the outside world. And because, for instance, at LSE, I was doing a lot of like policy work, TV interviews. And this I really liked. And I thought, maybe I could just do that. Which is fine, but actually I realized, well, you could also just do this as an academic, because you do have the freedom at least to choose how you do things to some extent.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, I think you've definitely shown that throughout your academic trajectory that there's always been a very strong link, as we mentioned in the beginning, towards the political and the corporate world. So I think that also grounds you maybe a little bit more, that it's not really an ivory tower at all, that there's really a practical connection to the outside world. Yeah.
Well, I guess for students, I mean, maybe, you know, to finish up on kind of why and how I ended up doing research, I think it's very important to keep every door open and to question the choices that you make and not just let yourself go through the tsunami and then, you know, kind of go through the wave and happen that, well, I have a master in, I don't know, economics, psychology or whatever, and I don't like this, and why am I doing that? So I think it's I don't know how it's in Belgium, but I know in France it was not really a big thing to stop and think and ask you and reflect on the choice that you make, because there were constraints, because there was always a deadline after another deadline. And I do feel like taking time to reflect on these choices is important, because then it's your life, and these choices that you make actually have quite a big implication of what, you know, you end up doing later on. And I think probably because it's like I have a lot of friends around their 30s that decided after 5 years working in something to do something completely different, typically very manual, not intellectual at all, because they felt like, why am I doing this job that I feel is pointless? So I think it's important to reflect, not every day, but, you know, at these very important kind of roads.
This was Profcast with Elsa Le Romain. Thank you for listening. Do you want to hear more? Then be sure to visit our website www.uantwerpen.be-profcast.